With every paragraph of Good Medical Practice, we wrote it in mind of the context, the environment, the pressures that doctors face. And of course, patient care and safety should be at the heart of every decision.
You're listening to Medical Protection Podcast, Good Medical Practice Series. Hello, I'm Jaylen Simsek, your host from the previous episodes. For today's podcast, I'll be joined by our previous co-host, Dr. Sabira Hughes, and our previous guests, Yale and Tista from the GMC, to discuss the updated professional standards for all doctors, Good Medical Practice 2024. In this final episode, we will look at the updated duties around patient-centered care and what this means in practice for doctors. To start off with, Good Medical Practice 2024 has put front and center a significant emphasis on having a patient-centered approach for clinicians. This is not a new concept in medicine, and doctors have done this for a long time. So what was the reason for including greater emphasis on partnership with patients within GMP?
Yale, if you could please respond to that question.
You're absolutely right. It's not a new concept at all. I remember hearing it many years ago and thinking it was quite an odd phrase. Surely all care is patient-centered. Well, what's it centered on if not the patient? But as the healthcare environment and working practices have changed over the years, it's come to mean something more specific about seeing the patient as a unique individual, not making assumptions about what their needs might be or what outcome they're hoping for. So we focused on how to make the most of the interaction that you have with a patient, having a meaningful dialogue, listening to patients and asking questions to encourage them to talk not just about their symptoms, but what matters to them about their life and health. What are their concerns and preferences about the available options? Checking the patient's understanding, making sure you're on the same page in terms of likely outcomes, and making sure that they have enough time and support to make an informed decision. These are all principles that we've brought into Good Medical Practice from existing more detailed guidance on decision making and consent, because they're indicative of how the doctor-patient partnership has continued to develop over the years. We first used the term doctor-patient partnership in the 2006 edition of Good Medical Practice, when it was a relatively new concept and some doctors still treated patients as passive recipients of care. Now the expectation is to work in partnership with patients to assess their needs and priorities. And when talking about treatments, we've added propose to provide or arrange to emphasize patient choice. And they're principles that are central to recognizing each patient as an individual with diverse needs, which is really at the heart of patient-centered care.
Tista, in your experience, are there differences between doctors' and patients' perceptions of patient-centered care? And if so, what are the main differences, please?
That's a really interesting question and a bit of a tough one, though there can be a difference. You know what, I'm going to start with an anecdote. When we consulted for the last edition of Good Medical Practice back in 2012, we asked doctors and patients what makes a good doctor. Now, that was in addition to academically robust research, which of course we also undertook, but that question was something that we asked at events, we had polls on, etc., at conferences. So not scientific, but the answers were really interesting. Both groups, so patients and doctor groups, came up with broadly the same answers, but the most common one from patients was listens. So what makes a good doctor? A doctor who listens. And that came above knowledge and skills. With doctors, on the other hand, it was the other way around. But going back to patient-centered care more broadly, it's really important, I think, to emphasise that research and development on all of this over the years has been led in collaboration. It's been led by doctors and patients as well as academics. And going back to the 60s, it was Carl Rogers, a psychologist, who started talking about person-centered care. That was the language then, and those ideas evolved by 2001. Across the water, the Institute of Medicine included patient-centeredness as one of its key aims. Over here, we had the NHS plan in 2000, which talked about personalisation. And since then, we've had Wandless and Darcy and, of course, now Prof. Alf Collins and various initiatives, essentially, that have helped shape policy focused on patient-centred care. Listeners might also remember the report Patient Preferences Matter, which highlighted the issue, and this is what some of what Yale was talking about actually, that issue that patients' preferences weren't being successfully diagnosed in the same way that their conditions were. And I remember a study, we used to share it a lot at conferences, that showed there can be a lot of assumptions. There was Lee et al., which looked at how doctors believed that 71% of patients with breast cancer rated keeping their breast as a top priority, but the actual figure from patients was 7%. That goes very much back to the assumptions that Yale was talking about earlier. And more broadly, in terms of different perceptions, I'm sure many listeners will, of course, remember Dr. Kate Granger's campaign, Hello, My Name Is, and that was born, of course, of her own experience as a doctor who became a patient and the lack of person-centeredness she sometimes experienced. So to sum up, whilst I think there can be a difference in perceptions across patients and doctors, there is, in general, mutual recognition on themes such as compassion, shared decision-making, and other core tenets of patient-centeredness now. And this is the care that doctors want to provide. So we hope that increasing that emphasis in the standards is something that's empowering.
And Yael, would you like to add anything to that before we move on?
Yes, just in terms of what patients and doctors might see differently about the term patient-centered care. I can imagine that, particularly since the pandemic, when there are such pressures on the system and it can be difficult to get a GP appointment and there are long waiting lists to see a specialist, you don't necessarily feel as a patient that the care is centered on you. But we have been realistic about the professional standards set out in Good Medical Practice. We know that the average doctor doesn't have much control over hospital waiting lists or how much time they can spend with a patient, but they can listen and they can try not to make assumptions about options or outcomes a patient will prefer. They can see patients as a unique individual and work in partnership with them.
And Yael, I like that you mentioned not making assumptions, because that ties nicely into my next question, which was looking at the detail. I noticed there's a new paragraph 24 on supporting patients to make informed decisions about their health and the presumption of capacity for adult patients. This was previously set out in the decision-making and consent guidance. So why has it moved into the central guidance document?
Well, in short, because it's so important. Before this update of Good Medical Practice was published last year, the most recent guidance update that we'd done was decision making and consent, which was published during the pandemic in 2020. So it was the thing that we'd most recently consulted on, and it contained the most up-to-date description of the standards expected of doctors in terms of supporting patients to make informed decisions about their care. And decision making is at the heart of patient care, the description of a meaningful dialogue where the outcome isn't a foregone conclusion because both the patient and the doctor have a part to play and information to exchange, which could tip the balance in favour of one option over another. That dialogue, that meaningful dialogue, is central to effective patient care, and so it had to be included in Good Medical Practice.
And for clinicians who have a conscientious objection to a particular procedure, the guidance now has a different emphasis, I noted, and it's paragraph 21 of Good Medical Practice that I'm thinking about specifically. My understanding of the revision that has been made is that it is now less important to explain the nature of the objection, but more about ensuring that the patient gets access to the care that they need. And it's also a much shorter paragraph than before. And Yael, I wondered about the nature of these changes and what was behind it.
Well, your assessment of what the paragraph means is absolutely spot on, Sabi. From the patient's point of view, the chances are they've already made a decision and just want to access the procedure, whatever it is that the doctor has a conscientious objection to. Or if the patient hasn't made a decision, then they might want to discuss the options and how they relate to their circumstances. But what they probably don't want to do is find out about their doctor's religious beliefs, for example. The best case scenario, they won't be interested and will just be anxious to discuss it with somebody who doesn't hold that conscientious objection. But worst case scenario, they'll potentially feel judged and upset. So we've removed the requirement to explain your conscientious objection and instead focused on the duty to make sure that the patient can access care to meet their needs. The wording is, if you have a conscientious objection, you must make sure that the way you manage this doesn't act as a barrier to a patient's access to appropriate care to meet their needs. Of course, if the patient wants to know why, and if the doctor's happy to share that with them, then that's at the doctor's discretion. We're not necessarily saying don't do it. We just no longer require it. It's a question of playing by ear and judging in the individual circumstances. Declaring a conscientious objection can be difficult without implying judgment of the patient's actions. So we reference paragraph 87 in that paragraph on conscientious objection. And paragraph 87 says not to express your beliefs in ways that exploit patients' vulnerabilities or could reasonably cause them distress. Both paragraphs also reference our more detailed guidance on personal beliefs and medical practice.
And Tista, the world has changed quite a lot since 2019, and I'm sure our listeners and we can all remember the pandemic, even though it happened around 4 years ago. And remote consultations have also changed the way medicine is practiced in some clinical settings. It's something that can be of benefit to patients and doctors, and it can also solve some of the pressures of resourcing and service provision. But it has its downsides also. How does the updated GMP reflect this changing landscape?
Yeah, absolutely. I think remote consultations really exemplify how much practice has changed since 2013. And of course, the wider changes are why we needed to update the standards more broadly. But in terms of remote consultation specifically, we already cover the mode of consultation in good practice in prescribing and managing medicines and devices, which is a bit of a mouthful, isn't it? But yes, we already cover the mode of consultation in that. And as you say, given the increase in remote consultations, it felt appropriate to include something in our core standards as well to reflect that changing landscape. And of course, as part of that, we were mindful of the benefits and the downsides that you mentioned there. We know that there can be safety concerns about remote consultations from both patients and also doctors. And we have had myriad discussions with doctors on the ground about those concerns. So now when you access paragraph 9 on remote consultations, there's actually a link to our Ethical Hub advice on remote consultations, and that provides advice. It includes a flowchart to aid decision making. And we know doctors really value that. So my team also run case discussions with doctors on remote consultations where we explore the duties, we explore the learning tools, and the feedback is that it really helps them weigh up when a remote consultation might be appropriate and when an in-person would be more suitable. So we are reflecting that changing landscape in both the standards themselves, but also in the support that we provide.
Prioritising patient safety is fundamental to the new paragraphs on safe delegation in the guidance. We all know the reality is that delegation often happens under pressure of a rushed handover or in emergency settings. It's the clinicians that accept that task, and then they realise it is not actually within their level of competence. But as a junior doctor, sometimes it can be really difficult for that junior clinician to say no. And what I was pleased to see is that the GMC has really supported clinicians by including a safety check to say that the clinician must ask for help if they need it, even if they have accepted that delegated task. So I was really pleased to see that in the guidance. And I'm interested to know why this change came about, and Tista, what your thoughts are on these changes.
Thanks, Abby. I'm really glad that you've picked up on that element of the duties. And I think you'll find that throughout there are similar supportive safety nets, whether we're talking bystander duties or inadequate resources, or as in this case, delegation. With every paragraph of Good Medical Practice, we wrote it in mind of the context, the environment, the pressures that doctors face. And of course, patient care and safety should be at the heart of every decision. But during the consultation, doctors told us that they really want to promote patient-centered care, but their environments can make it extremely challenging. So they wanted a bit of help. Medicine, of course, we all know can be really hierarchical. So culture is also something that we are aiming to address with the standards, as you know, and in hierarchical environments, we know that less experienced colleagues, those with less power, those with less influence, can find it really difficult to say no, just as you just said. And they can also find it really difficult to just ask for help. So given that we want the standards to support doctors, we framed the duty in that way very deliberately, and we very deliberately hope to empower them. We've talked in previous episodes about using the standards as a positive lever for change, and paragraph 67 is another example of that.
Yeah, and just to build on what Tista said, and exactly as you said in the question, it's about empowering the doctor being delegated to, as we said, who's more likely to be junior, empowering them to speak up if they don't feel competent. And if the junior doctor hasn't spoken up but doesn't feel competent, because of the way that we've drafted the duty, when it says prioritise patient safety and seek help, it's not saying who you have to go to for that help. You don't have to go back to the person who delegated the task to you if they're not available, or if you don't have a good relationship with them, or for whatever reason. There's still that added step for prioritising patient safety, where you can go to someone else and ask for support or supervision. And we've got more detailed guidance on delegation and referral, which goes into this in a bit more detail. But the bottom line is, don't do it, even if you've agreed to, if you don't feel competent.
Thank you. And what do the updated standards say about the continuity of care? Are there any new duties in this area that we need to think about? Yale, I wondered if you could help with that.
Sure. Well, continuity of care is important for all patients, but especially more vulnerable patients who might struggle to navigate their healthcare journey or to advocate for themselves. There's a danger they can fall through the gaps, and there are various points along the journey that continuity can be broken. When a shift ends, transfers between GP and hospital, say, or from hospitals to care homes, for example. So along with the duty to share relevant patient information with colleagues involved in their care, within and across teams as necessary, there's a new duty in Good Medical Practice 2024 to keep the patient informed, to share information with them about where they are on the care path, what's happened up to now and why, and what's likely to happen next, and to give them the name of the lead clinician or team who has overall responsibility for their care. Record keeping is also important for continuity, and as well as recording clinical information, test results, drugs prescribed and so on, we suggest recording information about reasonable adjustments to make that will help patients access care, and the patient's communication support preferences, as well as other information that might be relevant to ongoing care about their concerns and preferences. Going back to patient-centered care, recording what's important to the patient can improve their care going forward. When we commissioned research with patients at the beginning of the review, one of the things that came across really clearly was that patients appreciate continuity. They prefer not to have to retell their story at the start of every consultation and really appreciate doctors taking the time to familiarise themselves with their medical history. Having said that, we do know that time isn't always available. The sustained pressure on the medical workforce means that providing continuity of care is more and more challenging in today's healthcare systems. So we look carefully at the expectations in good medical practice as we were developing them, and we tested them with practicing doctors to make sure that they're all things that an individual doctor has control over. Because of this, some of the changes we've made relax rather than strengthen duties that were previously there. For example, going back to record keeping, we say to take a proportionate approach to the level of detail you record. And in terms of being accessible when you're on duty, we no longer say that doctors must be readily accessible, and we've removed the requirement to be accessible to patients as well as colleagues. We want the expectations in good medical practice to be realistic and achievable for doctors in today's healthcare environment.
Over the course of these episodes, we've talked about various themes you're addressing in good medical practice, from creating compassionate cultures to tackling discrimination to promoting patient-centered care. There's a lot to address in just one set of standards for a busy profession. Tista, are you prioritizing any of these themes?
It's definitely a lot to cover, but what I would say is whether you are looking at the Charaka Samhita from ancient Indian medicine or Hippocrates or Paracelsus, there have always been extensive ethical codes written by and embraced by the profession. So fast forwarding a few centuries and turning to the new standards, all are equally important, but standards have always covered a large range of themes, and listeners will find that there is a lot that has remained the same. We aren't starting from scratch with these concepts, and it is very much evolution, not revolution. All that said, some areas are significantly strengthened, and those are the areas that doctors and patients told us they wanted and needed the most help with. So that evolving social contract through a modern lens. And that brings me to the areas covering tackling discrimination and creating compassionate cultures. Whilst I wouldn't say that they are necessarily more important, the cultures colleagues work in, as we've been talking about, their environments, that ultimately can inform everything else. So whilst we have support to help colleagues on the ground implement all of new GMP, we are particularly focusing on working with organisations to help create that culture change. So yes, that's probably a slightly convoluted way of saying that much of the standards aren't new. Listeners will already be practicing in line with them. So the strengthened facets on creating culture change are key. It will help implement all of GMP as that shared agreement. And my plea to listeners is to see standards that way. As I said in our very first episode, these aren't edicts from up on high. They are a positive lever for change. And that's how I would love listeners to prioritise the standards.
Yael, would you like to add any final thoughts?
I think I'd just like to add to what Tista said, that everything starts with culture. Staff happiness, staff well-being, staff retention, which is so crucial in today's NHS, and of course ultimately patient care and patient safety. So it might be the area where there's the most work to do in your organisation, but if you can get it right, it could have such a positive impact.
And with that, we reach the end of today's podcast, Patient-Centred Care, and also the end of our series discussing good medical practice. Thank you to Dr. Sabira Hughes for joining as a co-host. Thank you to Yael and Tista from the GMC for sharing their valuable knowledge. And most importantly, thank you to our listeners who have joined on this journey with us. We hope that you have found these episodes useful. To learn more about what we covered today and who you were listening to, please take a look in the podcast description. I've been your host, Jaylen Simsek.
And I've been your host, Sabiri Hughes. Thank you for joining us.